One of the things that we know about stress is that its first and most immediate impacts tend to be physical. That is, the physical and hormonal changes that are occurring within the body are not only symptoms of and reactions to stress, but they are also, in fact, exacting a toll upon us. So taking a look at the physical side and what we can do to deal in a physical way with the stresses that are being imposed upon us is very helpful. It's a base, a starting point, a foundation that we want to consider first. 25 to 30 years ago, people who talked about healthful practices, who talked about certain physical regimens, who were concerned with diet, were often written off as health faddists, as kooks, as people on a physical culture trip. And the fact was that some of them were not relying on as much research as they might have thought. But in the intervening several decades, this has been one of the most heavily researched and most heavily tested areas of knowledge in the health sciences. The fact is, nutritional science is indeed now a science. That sports medicine and what we understand about physical conditioning and its impacts mentally and on other kinds of health states of the organism is a very replete knowledge area. We have some very hard facts and figures on which we can base many of the following recommendations. I'm going to suggest two lists of prescriptions. The first of these I'm going to call immediate prescriptions to reduce stress. If you do any of these things, the immediate effect, and I mean within 24 hours, will be to reduce the amount of stress that you are imposing upon yourself through some of your own physical and health practices. They can be done quickly, if not necessarily easily. A first suggestion, and these are not in any order of priority, is to reduce your current caffeine consumption. How many cups of coffee a day do you drink? How many bottles of cola? There are several statistics that we can give you. For example, in an average cup of brewed coffee, there are 143 milligrams of caffeine. Many people will drink as many as 10 to 15 cups of coffee a day. Let's assume it's a 10-cup-a-day person. That's going to be 1,430 milligrams of caffeine. Now, how much caffeine is that really? Well, let's assume that we were to compare that to a stimulant that's widely advertised to keep you awake. On the label for such products, the manufacturers indicate the amount of caffeine that can be taken over a 24-hour period without requiring a prescription. And if you read the label of any of those products, do it the next time you're in the drugstore, you'll find that the maximum dosage allowed in a 24-hour period without prescription is 700 milligrams of caffeine. That amounts generally to 7 100-milligram tablets. Now let's go back to our person who's had 10 cups of coffee that day. He's had 1,430 milligrams. He's already taken twice the acceptable legal limit of caffeine. Anything more than 700 milligrams of caffeine in the federal government requires a physician prescription. But because over-the-counter products are widely available and part of a relatively non-regulated area, people take them without thinking about intake limits. The same applies to heavy coffee drinking. The only difference is that the caffeine is in a warm, brown-colored, flavored water. Whatever your level of caffeine intake, if you reduce that level, you will reduce some of the associated physical response mechanisms. Under high caffeine stimulation, the adrenals will increase the amount of adrenaline, thereby increasing your heart rate and your blood pressure. That's why one of the standard prescriptions given by cardiologists to any heart patient is to reduce caffeine content. Well, you can do that before you become a cardiologist patient and perhaps avoid becoming one. I have learned that I react to too much caffeine with an anxious feeling, and that also is a known result of heavy stress. Another suggestion is that if you smoke, you reduce the amount you smoke or quit completely. In addition to whatever we know about smoking and its possible impacts on heart disease and on cancer, we also know that smoking retards, slows down, the normal metabolic processes by which the body purges itself of stress byproducts. Let me say that more simply. Stress creates a lot of useless, excess chemicals in the bloodstream. The body has a way of cleaning that out, but if you're a smoker, particularly if you're a heavy smoker, that process is slowed down, which means that that clean-out process doesn't occur, and stress effects last longer and have a more long-range impact on you. A third suggestion: reduce the amount of sugar in your diet. A few years ago, a book written entitled Sugar Blues documented in a very careful set of research studies the impact of high sugar intake. Sugar, especially in large quantities, is a known depressant. If you want to feel blue and down, have a big chocolate soda. Many people who may be feeling negative about themselves or about the world generally, feeling a little blue, will have an extra piece of blueberry pie, which simply creates more of this feeling. It's a vicious cycle. In one study done in a New England boarding school where it's possible to control teenage diet, the students were separated into two groups. One group continued to eat the typical American teenage diet of chocolate milkshakes and pie, and the other was given a reduced sugar diet. Instead of getting sugar cereals, they often received oatmeal. Instead of getting lots of confectioners and manufactured sugars, they got natural sugars through fruit. At the end of the school year, the two groups were compared in a number of areas. It was found that those that had the lower sugar intake had captured a majority of the student body officer positions, had more friends, by actual count had established more social relationships, and had a higher grade point average. The group that had had the high sugar concentration tended to act out more in class, were more likely to write home to a parent or to call home saying that they were homesick or they couldn't handle the situation and wanted to leave. We know that sugar, in fact, does have some major effects. The amount of sugar eaten by people in the United States is higher than any other country in the world, with the exception of the English. So you may want to consider a possible diet change that would reduce your sugar intake. A fourth suggestion as we look at habit improvement steps which can, combined, lead to a very powerful program for stress handling is to take a look at the adequacy of the diet in terms of the vitamin levels being ingested. If you're eating a diet that has a lot of salad greens, a lot of citrus fruit, and high levels of vitamins B and C, then your diet will help you deal with some of the stress situations you may encounter. It is known that under stressful conditions, the B-complex vitamins, B1, B6, B10, B12, and vitamin C, all of which are water-soluble, tend to become depleted. That is, under stressful conditions, these vitamins are washed out of the system. It's not known exactly why, but two theories currently exist. One is that the body is using these vitamins as it metabolizes stress compounds in the bloodstream. Another theory is that vitamins B and C do not have anything at all to do with stress handling, but that they're simply depleted in stressful situations. Both theories agree on the central point, and that is that a person under stress will exhibit, if diet is inadequate, certain vitamin deficiencies. Now, what happens to a person who is deficient in their levels of vitamin B and C? Well, it's known, for example, that in schizophrenics, whatever problems they have are intensified by the absence of vitamin B. As a matter of fact, some schizophrenic treatment therapies consist simply of administering large injections of the B-complex vitamins, and that has alleviated some of their perceptual problems and hallucinations. So we know that these vitamin deficiencies can cause a whole variety of illnesses and other problems. I'm not going to recommend that you start taking any kind of pill, but I will note that the Food and Drug Administration has licensed some major vitamin makers to market products using the word stress on the label, stress vitamins, stress tabs, and others. Typically, these are nothing but a B-complex vitamin combined with some vitamin C. If you think your diet is adequate, do not take vitamin pills. But if it's not, you might want to consider that possibility. And of course, follow the directions on the label, because your body can only use the amount prescribed in the label directions. Last in our list of immediate stress-reducing remedies that will equip the body to more adequately contend with stress is a suggestion that you have daily rest breaks. Remember my dad, the electronics company president? He always maintained that he felt better if he laid down on a cot in his office for a half-hour nap at noontime. Because he was president of the company and could do anything he pleased, that's exactly what he would do. He'd come into the office at 6 o'clock in the morning, work his first 6 hours, eat lightly, lie down for 30 minutes, get up and work his second 6-hour shift. And he said that he was always more recharged in the afternoon because of it. It has, in fact, been found that worker productivity will increase following breaks and after the lunch break. In fact, American industry went to the practice of instituting morning and afternoon breaks when the industrial engineers heard of this discovery by the physicians. People are more productive immediately following breaks than they are during an uninterrupted and lengthy period of time. For me, taking a 15-minute walk at noontime is very restful. The key question here is, what would be most restful for you? What would help you recharge? In some corporate environments, because the culture there is accepting, executives, office workers, and others bring an exercise mat and lie down on the floor or have a cot in the office. In other environments, that might not be acceptable at all. If you can't do it during the day, perhaps you can establish a policy in your home that says, "When I walk through the door, do not descend on me with the problems of the day. Do not, as I walk through the door, having dealt 8 hours with a boss I can't stand and an hour and a half of traffic I can't bear, descend on me and say, 'Let me tell you what Johnny did today to your stamp collection.' Instead, when I walk through the door, there will be a 30-minute hiatus. Don't talk to me. Don't touch me. Let me alone." You might want to go to your favorite chair. You might want to put on some relaxing music. The point is that what you're trying to do is put an insulator between a stressful period and the next period of your day. And if you can let yourself come back into contact with reality and get the nerves slightly unjangled, you will then be ready to hear and deal with any new challenge. There are a number of home environments that I'm aware of using that practice and finding that it works very well. There is a second set of remedies, things that can be done physically that can help you, but these are on a longer-term basis. That is, if you start them today, you're not going to see an immediate impact, though you might see something within a relatively short period of time of several weeks. The suggestions I've previously outlined have the effect of reducing the amount of stress that you're putting into the body by way of smoking and caffeine and sugar and inadequate vitamins and so on, while the following suggestions affect your physical capacity to carry the load of stress. Our earlier analogy was that while we're not atlases, we all do have to shoulder a certain weight. Can we increase our weight-carrying capacity? Can we, by being stronger physically, have a correspondingly stronger mental capacity to deal with stressors? The answer appears to be a resounding yes. People who are in good physical condition are better candidates to handle high stress levels than are those that are not. That fundamental understanding underlies the intensive physical conditioning that astronauts get, because those astronauts are not going to be in a situation or condition where they need great physical strength to handle the physical demands of weightlessness. Yet they need that physical strength because it equips them with a capacity to handle other stressors. I have several suggestions then in this longer-term and very powerful area of stress management. The first question to consider is, when was the last time you had a complete physical? Medical opinion varies, but generally physicians agree that by the time you reach the age of 40, you should be having a physical exam every year. Some, because of recent health statistics that have been indicating that people at younger and younger ages are having stress problems, are now recommending that physicals should be given every year starting at age 35. What you're doing through a routine physical is having a knowledgeable observer, someone who has a history and statistics in terms of lab workups, EKGs, blood pressure readings, and so on, take a look at where you are right now. This physician can give you some additional insight in terms of what this data means. If the weight is getting out of line, if blood pressure readings are going up, if physical conditioning seems to be going downhill, this is someone who can help you by giving you necessary explanations and perhaps warnings. The other thing that the physician can do is to actually assess your resistance. There are a number of stress-measuring tests. One of the oldest is what is known as the STEP test. More recently, stress tests use treadmills and measure lung capacity, pulse rate, and blood pressure under varying physical strains. And using some of this more sophisticated technology, physicians are able to give you a good indication of how resistant to stress you are. That is, how capable are you of handling stress. Having that base of information first, you can then enter into an exercise regimen. Of all of the remedies we have suggested thus far, exercise is one of the most powerful and most important aspects of an overall stress management program that can be undertaken. While not everyone needs to reduce their sugar intake, everyone does need to be involved in some form of physical exercise. General current thinking is that this should be something appropriate to your age and to your physical condition. You do not have to become an Arnold Schwarzenegger. You do not have to be the ideal human specimen. It is not necessary to build muscle mass or to be a person that others are going to admire, as in the Charles Atlas ads on the beach. What you are in need of is some kind of exercise program that will increase cardiopulmonary capacity, that will increase the heart's strength and ability to pump blood, and will increase the lung capacity to improve the oxygenation of that blood. Both of those steps help you in a high-pressure situation. If the heart is under stress and is having to pump more rapidly, a heart muscle that is strong will be able to deal with that increased load much more readily than will a heart that is weak and is not used to carrying that kind of load. Again, by way of simple logic and simple explanation of some very complex physiological processes, increasing the oxygenation of the blood tends to more readily metabolize certain byproducts of stress. Are you physically fit in these two most important areas of cardio and pulmonary capacity? Everyone can certainly be involved in a walking program. The object is to begin and maintain any kind of exercise that is going to use the large leg muscles. It was found by Dr. Kenneth Cooper and a variety of other sports medicine people that leg muscle exercises or utilization are highly efficient in terms of producing increased cardiopulmonary capacity. So a walking program, a jogging program, if you're up to that, certain court sports like tennis, racquetball, squash, volleyball are all excellent. One of the very best all-around exercises is swimming. Swimming and walking are perhaps the two best exercises for those who may be out of shape. Talk to your physician, decide on a particular program, something that you can do for the long, slow distance. Do not enter a program expecting an instant transformation. You must look for some kind of exercise that you can take with you into your old age and continue to do every day of your life, a minimum of 3 times a week for 30 minutes. These exercise programs are widely available in the popular press and in bookstores. And by talking with some folks at the Y or at some of the other health clubs, you can find many options that will be appropriate. No one is exempt from this recommendation. A third consideration would be to take a look at your current diet and sleep patterns. Are you getting enough rest? Are you getting enough of the right kind of food? If you are what you eat, who wants to be a Twinkie? If you're eating good, you'll feel good. And when you feel good physically, your attitude tends to improve. If you're not feeling good physically, you're not going to handle social interactions as well. you're not going to feel as good about yourself in terms of your self-esteem and self-image. Get enough sleep, feel good about yourself physically, feel good about yourself mentally. Lastly, take a good close look at your drinking habits and your use of prescribed and non-prescribed drugs. Such substances cannot truly control or manage the day-to-day stresses we encounter. In fact, instead of alleviating our problems, they too often become serious problems themselves. Unfortunately, few of us have the opportunity to spend time with the kind of doctor who is able to sit down for an hour to talk about the problems we're having. Many physicians these days will encounter 40 patients in the course of a busy practice day and will spend less than 3 minutes with each of those patients. When you say to them, "Doc, I'm feeling a little uptight," he says, "Here, take some of these, you'll feel better." That kind of prescribing was criticized a few years ago by the then director of the Food and Drug Administration when he addressed the American Medical Association. During that speech, he said, "The nation has turned into a nation of addicts," and then indicated he was looking at the pushers. What the FDA director was referring to is the fact that a majority, over 50%, of the people in the United States are now on not illegal drugs, but legal drugs, prescribed tranquilizers, painkillers, muscle relaxants, and that those drugs have been given to them by physicians who, instead of looking for other non-chemical cures for that patient's stress or discomfort in life, have been quick to pop pills into their hands. To their credit, the physicians in the United States in the last few years have cut back markedly on these prescriptions. Yet even in this current year, the number one prescription product in the United States is Valium. I'm amazed at the number of times that I can ask an audience what the single most widely prescribed prescription product is, and how many people in the audience will know the answer. The second most widely prescribed drug is Librium, Valium's sister drug. It is an interesting comment on our time. In Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, he talked about a future time in which the culture would be narcotized, and in which the population would be controlled through the use of a drug called Soma. In fact, we are living in a brave new world, a 1984 pattern of behavior. Let's see if we can get off of those tranquilizers and find some other, more positive physical approaches.